Cause you need to get back in the arms of a good friend. And I need to get back in the arms of a girlfriend.
Hello, this is Aaron Kupferberg from PowerPopaholic.com interviewing Matthew Sweet for the Rock and Roll Report. I just wanted to, you know, congratulate you on Under the Covers Volume 2.
Thank you.
And I wanted to, you know, just ask a few basic questions on that. Do you feel, you know, since you've already done Volume 1 with a bunch of covers, was there anything different about this volume as far as selecting the songs? Or did you and Susie split decide what songs would go on the playlist?
No, you know, even on the first one, we actually never made a list and then did that list. I think we started to make a list, and the first one on our list was She May Call You Up by The Left Bank, and then we just thought, this is awesome, we'll just come up with them as we go. On the 70s, there were a few things that were surprising about it. One was, you know, we just think of ourselves that the 60s is sort of our bag, you know? And so we just weren't ready for all the feelings we had about the 70s. We think it comes from, one, the ages we were at. I was, 12 years old in 1976. Sue was, 17 that year or whatever, or 18, something like that. So we were both in this very teenage sort of scene years, and influenced by older brothers that listen to music, and, you know, FM rock radio, you know, AOR radio format when it was really new and what it was supposed to be. You heard a million album tracks and everything.
Right.
And so a lot of music was in our consciousness from then that wasn't stuff that necessarily are our banner things that we go around going, oh, these are our heroes. You know what I mean? It was more haphazard. For starters, there were very different musical movements, you know. I'm so glad the Raspberries ended up on it because, you know, there's so much of that kind of music. We do just a whole album of it, you know. Some of the Raspberries, Rundgren stuff, Big Star, like, I'm glad those kinds of things got on it. That's maybe more what people would think we would do, although I know, I think, about that realm of stuff a lot deeper than sort of Susie does. So sometimes it's just about which things do we both click on that we both think, let's try that, you know, sticking songs we don't know on each other. And in the 70s, there were a lot of these well-known songs that we knew but still thought, wow, let's cover that, you know. It's just really in a selfish way, like it would be fun for us to cover it, because that's really how we've done these records. And I think they're different than a lot of covers records. I just thought of this recently, that in that it's almost like we cover the record as much as we cover the song. And I think that's really unusual. People are usually trying to do a cover and kind of not be like the original, or they at least don't pay attention to it, really, you know, and oftentimes try to really reinvent something. But for me, as a fan of music, I think I never cared about covers as much by artists kind of because of that. They generally just weren't a great record like the thing they're covering, you know? So not really in a way where we were consciously doing it, but I think with the 60s record, we were kind of very, very true to the originals, and then on the 70s, you know, we have been too. I mean, to the extent that it's easy to do just using Pro Tools in the box and, you know, at home with me, the terrible engineer, you know? So,
Sure, sure. No, I mean, you've got a kindred spirit in the Smithereens. They just finished a Beatles cover tribute as well as a Who cover tribute.
Wow, that's got to be awesome.
You know, and they did the entire album, not just one song.
It's funny because Sue and I have talked about doing a whole Yes album after our Yes cover on the 70s record.
Awesome, awesome.
So in a way, the 70s one became a little more about pop culture and less, even less about, like, our coolness of, like, these are the things we'd really be into. Part of the Sid and Susie thing also, in that it's been, we've never really toured that much or anything, in our kind of realm of friends in L.A. and kind of people that work in, Sue's husband works in movies a lot, so a lot of movie people sort of have our CDs, and there's an aspect to it that's so much about sort of the spirit of it and enjoyment of the covers, more than it's about a hipster thing. You know what I mean? We want a lot of people to be able to feel what we feel, not to the point where we wouldn't do an obscure song because of that, but more we don't eliminate well-known things for any reason unless we just think, I don't want to do that, you know?
Right.
Now, oftentimes we tried really well-known things and didn't end up using them, you know?
That's what bonus tracks are for.
Yeah, and exactly, and a lot of our bonus tracks, like, for instance, we did a lot of new wave songs from the 70s, but it was hard to fit them with the classic rock. You know, the Raspberries, the Todd Rundgren, that stuff worked with it, sort of, but it seemed minimized to the late 70s kind of punk invasion songs. Like, they weren't in their best light to be with those songs. They seemed kind of more trivial than they sort of were, you know? And so, for instance, those are available as bonus tracks. There's a Buzzcocks song, a Ramones song, a Blondie song.
Right.
So, you know, we were trying to cover a lot of different areas of music. Maybe we kind of thought about that in the 70s one, but, you know, I've realized so much stuff that I got into that's going to be a lot more obscure I got into when I was in high school, which is 80 to 83, you know, so an 80s one might yield a lot more obscure things, you know?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of close to your age, so I see where you're coming from. I just wanted to ask, how has making music changed for you since the early days when you were on the major labels and, you know, since you went off and have changed around a bit?
Well, I think for starters, I'm a lot more confident. Back then, I was just so scared. I was freaked out kind of by everything, like a jumpy, skittish cat or something. You know, I think of that
right.
Because my cat, one of our cats is kind of like that. And I wanted to make music. I was kind of a music egghead in that I wanted to record at home with my own multi-track. And that's why I always loved people like, Todd Rundgren or Lindsey Buckingham, people that would record a lot on their own and multi-track, because that's kind of how I got into doing music, because I honestly was just too embarrassed to, like, do stuff in front of people much, you know, when I was young. I mean, I played in bands. I was usually the bass player. I had a band of my own sometime in high school, but it was like, it just was like I wasn't really confident to go out and sort of do that exactly, or the way I felt inside I wasn't anyway.
Yeah.
And once I started to have some success, you know, and for the first couple of records, I had kind of no success, so it worked for me pretty well because I didn't really have to tour that much.
Right.
But they started making me play on acoustic guitar then, which was just you have to play acoustic guitar and sing your songs on radio. Like that I guess started early in my career, like mid-80s, and they sent me out to do that, and I just was horrified. I'd never sat in a room with one person and played a song for them. I did all my recording alone, like in my room when no one was there, you know? And so that was how life was really different for me then. I was just really afraid. And I think then when I had some success, I still had those weird feelings of like, except I had to tour all the time and fly all the time, so I had way more anxiety. And I had this weird implied pressure that no matter how successful anything was, it still wasn't really enough, you know, which is always kind of the thing with labels. I think they mean to be excited when you sell gold, but very clear to you, they want you to sell, you know, platinum once you've done that or whatever. So that kind of made me slightly uptight and less carefree to sort of do music. But I managed to do some stuff and get through sort of the 90s. And I had, you know, another couple really successful records after Girlfriend, which, you know, is more than some people can say. So I feel really glad that that happened. Now I feel so much more able to do music, more free to let things happen. I feel like I understand what it is a lot better. I felt back then almost this weird guilt about, like, people thought it was something, but to me it was like air. It was like so insubstantial. I felt like I didn't do anything. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Now I understand what I do. I have some other hobbies. I learned to make pottery and throw clay on a wheel, and I fire it and glaze it and everything. And those kinds of things, doing that really helped me see music as a personal thing and understand that the more personal it is for me, the better. And that was always kind of a conflict with the idea of be the biggest star you can, you know?
Yeah, well, now you don't necessarily have to, you know, do a lot of that running around yourself. I mean, you have The girlfriend, I guess, was on the Guitar Hero 2 soundtrack. I mean, is there any plans to have Divine Intervention or Time Capsule or anything else on any future
games? There haven't been. You know, none of us really made money, the people that were on Guitar Hero 2, which, you know, the time at least, it may still be, I don't know, was the biggest selling video game of all time. And I didn't know about it until I just started hearing about it from friends. And I heard about it kind of for a year, and then I was at a party at a good friend of mine's house, and his kids had learned how to play it, and so he wanted to show me his son Jack doing Guitar Hero Girlfriend. And so he came out, and these people kind of gathered around, and starts doing it, and he's going for it. It's cool, it's funny, you know. But I thought, my God, that's me. It's my record. You know, and everyone's looking at me like, no, it's not. And I was like, it is. And they basically had imitated everybody so well. They got one band. It did every group on that album, or on that game.
Yeah.
And eventually, like, the Romantics tried to sue because it was so sounded so much like them. They're like, how can they do this, you know? I mean, it really sounded like everybody, you know, 38 Special and Lynyrd Skynyrd and all these bands were going to be in on it. But then the Romantics lost in their Michigan court, and whoever they were going to get in L.A. just kind of didn't want to take it with the precedent of them losing. Their argument, of course, is that you've gotten so much promotion worth more than they would ever give you from being in the game.
Right, right.
I kind of understand that, although how that translates to me ever selling records, I'm not exactly sure, but I like...
Well, you have people who...
children, you know.
Yeah, well, you have what I was going to say is you have people who don't even listen to CDs, like kids who are playing it and discovering this music for the first time.
And that is cool, and it will be... I think that there's a lot these days of how much information we take in, and especially younger people, just your name, just that the name got in their heads from playing that game.
Exactly.
Somehow has to be helpful, you know?
Exactly. Let me switch on over to your last album as well. One question also I want to ask before I leave Under the Covers Volume 2 is, what was it like working with Donny Harrison?
It was awesome. Sue knows him a little better than I do. I've met him a couple times, including when he came over to record. First of all, he's extremely George-like, so it's kind of amazing to see him. Like, it's kind of like, whoa, you know, he just got the vibe. Only he's, in my opinion, rather more handsome than George.
Okay.
And I think George is a really cool-looking dude, but Danny's really, he's really, like, a good-looking kid. And he also is really cool, but he's really friendly. A little bit of his personality, I think, reminds me kind of what I think I know about his dad from reading books and books and books over the years, of course.
So through DNA, it's just...
Danny has that moody side that can be sort of dark, but then he's just really friendly and open-minded about stuff. And one of the really cool things is that he loves his dad so much. He's, like, proud of him, likes to talk about him. It's not like this weird thing where he's trying to, like, you know, separate himself or whatever.
Right, right. I mean, out of all the other people that, you know, you did play, collaborated with a lot of people on this last one. Is there anybody you wished you could have played with, but you didn't get a chance to play with yet?
Well, you know, the whole guest star thing wasn't ever something we really thought of ourselves as doing. And it was only when we recorded the song by Yes and started thinking about lead guitar for it, one day we just had the idea, like, let's try to find Steve Howe and get him to play on it. Because it was just, his guitar playing was so cool, and yes, I just thought, if that's on it, we'll get away with it. You know what I mean?
Right.
And we were able to find Steve, and he was a lovely guy, and recorded a bunch of stuff for us, and was so amazing. And that sort of got our minds going for a minute, like, who else will we get, you know? But the problem is for us to really do that on a lot of our songs, especially because we were recording almost 40 songs for this one. It would have taken us years and years, you know, to deal with getting the people and then respond, and then they agree to do it, and they hear it, and then they do the thing when they have a chance, and then, you know what I mean? It's just a lot of work and a lot of money that we sort of didn't have. So we we had to kind of cool it on our ideas to do it all the time. In Lindsey Buckingham's case, we know Lindsey and his wife and ran into him a couple of times early this year, so I was able to corner him. Sue's like going, corner, ask him, no, corner him, about playing on our record.
All right, great. I mean, I know you...
He ended up on it almost in a friendly way, I guess is what I'm saying. And then Danny was really the same. He was... had run it. Sue had met him at a couple parties, and they were just had hung out a couple times, and she texted him and asked him, and he said sure. So those things were all really easy. If I had my dreams of just checking people out, you know, I would have loved to have had the Raspberries guys. We would love to have been able to have Bryson play guitar. Would love to have been able to have I'm having so much blanks today. The singer Eric Carmen.
That's okay.
Met those guys a little over a year ago. We went to their show in LA, and they were so awesome and so nice. I would have loved to have gotten them. They would have been probably the next people I went to. I would have loved to have, you know, gotten Richard Lloyd and done, you know, Marquee Moon instead of having to play it myself. It's one of our bonus tracks.
Right.
You know, okay. But kind of part of the charm and fun of our thing is trying to learn the parts myself and do as much of it as I can. And, of course, our friend Greg Leese does a million things on it. And my lead guitar player from Live, Pete Phillips, does some stuff. And
all right.
A few other extras, but... You know, like, for instance, our manager told us that Carly Simon was so excited because she heard we were covering her song and offered to sing on it if we wanted, but we were already done and mastered, you know what I mean? So, like,
okay.
We would have certainly done that, you know what I mean? We'd have hung out with Linda Ronstadt or whatever because of Willen, you know?
Yeah, well, Ian Hunter just finished his new album. You never know. He might want to join you on something.
Hey.
One of the other questions I had since... Susanna Hoffs has been on your regular albums as well as Under the Covers series. Is there any, for your next album or possible next album, would you continue to use her in capacity?
I think I would. I mean, it's funny. I really like girl singers. I'm a huge fan of Sue's voice, so to be able to work with her and the fact that just I know her so well now, we're like... I mean, she's like my sister. Like, we really know each other because we've just spent so much time together in home environments, you know?
Right.
And to think back and think that I would ever know her or be friends with her, because I just dug her voice. I had a feeling about her voice, and that's what's so funny about how we work well together. It's just funny to me. When I was, you know, I had the Rainy Day record during, you know, Paisley Underground, early 80s when I was in high school.
Right.
I listened to her voice, you know, and it just was so cool to me. It was like a voice from my time, you know, that really struck me. It had so much character. And so, you know, I watched them then go on and become so successful, and I met Sue over the 90s. But we really didn't just click to work until more recently. So if I wanted a girl vocal, absolutely I would use her. I would use her. I would use any of the Bangles. My wife's a good singer, you know. So it just has to be the kind of thing where I want female voices. You know, it worked really well for Sunshine Lies, the title track, because it was such a trippy kind of thing, you know?
Right. Getting back to Sunshine Lies, I read on a recent interview that you had a few other tracks that sort of fell by the wayside, one called Badass and a few other tracks that I was...
Badass is on the vinyl.
Oh, it is on the vinyl. I'm wondering if any of this is going to end up on a CD somewhere or...
It should. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I wish that had been on the album. It was kind of a huge oddity, and there were sort of, like, people that really hated it and people that really loved it. And, of course, we were going to do an EP with it and all the other nasty songs, but that kind of stuff is just to talk you into not using it, you know. But on that particular one, we did put it on the double vinyl album, and... It is really cool. Sometimes I almost think I could re-record it, because it was sort of like sound art. But I don't know. I'll probably do something else that's cool or whatever. But the idea that it was weird for me to be saying badass is so bizarre to me, because it just, everyone says it all the time. Like, ever since I've had that song, like, it's just all I hear.
Okay.
You know, whatever. It was kind of a novelty. My manager really went crazy for it, and all his kids who were in high school at the time, and he just wanted it so bad.
Yeah, well, as a longtime Power Pop fan, I have to give you full credit, you and Roger Manning Jr., the Jellyfish, for, like, the 90s revival of the genre.
Oh, man. Well, Jellyfish were mind-blowing because they're just, their whole studio approach and everything was so much more kind of intricate than mine, you know? I always thought of myself as a lot scrappier than those kind of people. I mean...
Yeah, well, you know...
I mean, Kravitz would go and, like, they make these, like, amazing sonic things, and Girlfriend was interesting sonically, but I didn't think of it as being, like, as crafted as that stuff, you know what I mean? And some of that Jellyfish stuff was so cool, and I got to meet those guys some back in the day. I remember once we played this huge stadium in D.C.,
yeah.
At the best radio station there, like a popular station that was actually good, you know? And it was like a huge stadium of people, and I got to meet those guys. I was talking to John for a while, and it was just cool that we were there at all, because it really, we were, you know, not like most of what was going on.
Yeah, that's what I think made you guys unique. And, you know, although in the past, you know, Power Pop was maybe a badge of ridicule at one point, I think now it basically says that you were great music, and bands that are identified like that are great classic rock and roll
music. Oh, yeah, yeah. Because a lot of it, they're the heirs to the really great Beatles stuff, and the sort of that approach of, you know, the thing is, I never thought it was embarrassing Power Pop, because Power Pop, as a term, even when I first, one of my first interviews I ever did for my record Earth in the mid, and I didn't even know what Power Pop was supposed to be exactly, or that I was Power Pop, you know? And I did this interview, and someone said to me, well, you're Power Pop, how does it feel to be part of a genre that never sells historically? That was like one of my very first interviews.
Oh,
I was like, well, I mean, that's awesome if I'm part of that, because I love all those kind of bands and stuff. You know, one of the cool things about the 90s is we were really discovering what Power Pop was, you know? People were starting to really categorize it and kind of make lineages of it and stuff. So it was fun to be part of that concept. I mean, just to be thought of as prominent in any part of music is exciting for me, and I love Power Pop type stuff. There's not much stuff I like better, really, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, except, you know, what, like, Brian Wilson or whatever, or John Lennon, you know, like I like as well, but that, you know, they're like, in a weird way, they're the godfathers of it to me, because what I loved was melody.
Absolutely.
I always wanted to hear melodies. Like, I loved Elvis Costello because he had melody. I loved XTC because they had melodies. I love when stuff is weird or experimental or whatever, but I was always looking for a feeling from a melody somewhere. They had to have, like, the sad song at the end or something, you know, that felt important, kind of, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
So, I do think of Power Pop maybe a little more as the upbeat end of kind of stuff like I do, but that's awesome, because, you know, that was always kind of the hardest thing when, you know, people looking for singles or radio, it's always harder to do faster songs that are good, that are upbeat and have energy, that are a song that feels like something, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
And isn't just fun, you know? So what I think's cool about Power Pop is it's really cool, and it's fun, and has great melodies. You know, it's memorable, and can be, a source of rebellion as well, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. I mean...
That's really, Green Day and all that stuff really became the super successful version of that kind of stuff, but it's a little different, you know, because it's more about a genre and less about all the unique people that love the Beatles or whatever, you know?
Right, exactly. Just... as a closer here, what's next for Matthew Sweet? A new solo album, of course. Yeah. Will Rick Menick be included?
Nick will be there. I'm going to make a new solo album. I'm going to get it started, I think, this fall. Try to finish it by early next year. Since it's all new songs, I haven't started anything. I can actually just make a record quick, and not, it won't take me forever like last time when I was sort of building it in batches over time, you know,
right,
and spending a long time in between things. I didn't work on it a lot, but it took me a long time to get it all together. This time I want to get another one out as quickly as I can, hopefully during next year, and go tour again, because I want to at least solidify my little thing, because people came out to see us play live, and that was awesome, no matter, some places we had tons of people, some places we had smaller crowds, but they were always awesome, you know?
Right.
So, just to be able to feel like I exist in that way, I think, is a lot of fun, and I just want to keep making records because I feel in a really good space to do it right now.
Well, we keep wanting to buy them, so don't stop.
You're awesome.
all right, great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Matthew. Matthew Sweet. I appreciate it.
You have a good one.
Okay, take care then.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.